From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. For over 20 years, Kevin Cordy has told stories in over 40 states, England, Scotland, Singapore, and Japan. His story work has been commissioned by the National Youth Storytelling Hall of Fame, Newsweek, and the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Kevin has been an actor, teacher, door-to-door salesman, starting at age 14, disc jockey, gas station attendant, and writer. More recently, he was the storyteller in attendance, the first storyteller in attendance, I should note, at The Ohio State University. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Kevin Cordy.
I'm glad to be here, Doc.
Well, we're glad to have you. So let's start off with the definition. Storytelling, how is it different than just telling a story, just telling somebody about an event? What defines storytelling?
Well, I guess it has a lot of continuum. I was raised on back porch storytelling, where if someone would sit down and just say, you knew to listen, you know, it was the way you were raised. But at the same time, there are people who perform for 2,000 people, and it's a professional art, and people learn it. And then there's also storytelling in business, where IBM is hiring consultants as storytellers, because what else are you doing if you're not selling your story? So there's a continuum of understanding of what storytelling is. To be a professional storyteller, some people good-naturedly say you get paid. Okay. But my mother was a great storyteller, and was never paid for that art.
Okay. So let's go back to that. What makes it different? Not just getting paid, but what are the elements of really good storytelling for you? What defines?
Sure. Well, you know, it involves practice. It involves really looking at what you're doing and building it based on what you know. Retelling a folk tale or a fairy tale and putting your own spins on it. People can commission you to tell stories based on an event. For example, we've had storytellers talk about the Johnstown flood. I've got a friend that's with NASA right now with the space shuttle and telling it right before. So there's a lot of different degrees and understanding with storytelling.
You have a storyteller with NASA.
Well, he's been commissioned by NASA to tell the story of space right before the space shuttle goes off.
Really? So is that like a narrative thing that he does?
It's a one-hour narrative.
No script,
non-rehearsed? No, he researched for probably 2 to 3 months just looking at how is this story going to be told. Okay. And then took interviews from a lot of people and really, you know, started to think, how will I tell this story? Okay. From different perspectives as well.
So how is that? That's a form of writing to me.
Sure.
It's writer's talk. But so tell me,
The greatest writers are storytellers.
Okay.
And you've had some of them here that they really know how to communicate what they want. And sometimes you can find stories through you can find writing through the storytelling process. I used to practice my stories. I'd go around a building, and I'd talk to myself. Mm-hmm. And there was this little old man who would run away every time he'd see me. Mm-hmm. And so I finally stood in front of him, and I said, I'm a storyteller. I need you to sit and listen to this story.
What building was this in?
This was in California, and right next to, it was around my apartment.
Okay.
And so I told my story, and he went away. And then the next week, he came to me. He sat down with his little dog, and he said, do you have a story for me today? And there's some kind of chemistry that happens when people are telling stories.
Okay. What story did you tell him that day?
I believe it was a story about Anansi, who is a trickster spider that I was telling for a number of kids at that time.
Okay.
And it's told differently every time I tell it.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about that because when you tell something as a writer, when I do writing, I'm particular about how I want things told. I want them in a specific order. I want them with specific inflections and things like that. But you have to be more fluid when you're a storyteller because you don't have the script to refer to. You don't have the...
I work with writers in a program that I created called Permission to Play. And I think sometimes we solidify it in print before we play with the words. And so, yes, you can reverse the order. You can change your tone. You can change your manner. And sometimes that will transfer into the writing. I don't think enough writers play with their words. And I also am a writer as well as a storyteller, and sometimes I have to sit back and say, wait a minute, I have to work this story first. I've got to live it. I've got to talk it out. I've got to speak. So there's a great deal that you can do as a storyteller if you want to be a writer as a storyteller.
So you're defining writer as different from storyteller. These are two different acts for you, two different cognitive thought processes. You sit down, you do one or the other.
It is, but you know, there are very few stories that can't be told. But there are some writings that you might, you'd have to struggle in different frames of mind. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I recently was with 2,000 high schoolers. Would I tell that same story that I'm with 500 sixth graders or 400 four-year-olds? Or sometimes I'm with a company of people. So you imagine sitting there with astronauts. Would I tell that same story? So just like a writer has to work with different audiences, I don't work myself over, you know, what defines the writer and what defines the storyteller. I think we can work from each other. They're cousins. Stories, you know, storytellers was the first theater. It's the first sense of oral writing that we've ever had.
So what do you think that you say they can work with each other, learn from each other? What do they have to teach each other? What can the storyteller teach the writer?
Well, I often work with writers. I was just in South Carolina, and there was a person that was telling a story, and it was about New Mexico and living near the radioactive fence as a child and couldn't see the inherent harm in this. And so she got up and I said, well, let's go in the story together. And all of a sudden, there were six other people. They started going bzzz, bzzz. And she said, oh, this fence was so friendly and we could climb under it. And I said, was it a radioactive fence? Yes, yes. And you'd hear bzzz.
So that sign, that was an electric fence or radio? That's a sign that said danger, radioactivity.
It was danger. It was danger. Okay. She said that the trees looked differently, and they glowed in the dark.
Yes,
and she did. And I've been to this place, and I've seen.
And you've
but
come
this
back.
This was the first time she said, look, I've worked on this story, and I've written this story for a long time, but this is the first time that I was inside the story, and I saw that there might be harm. But for me as a small child, I just saw it as a place to play. Mm-hmm. And so her playing with the words, actually physical playing with the words, and playing with others about the words helped her find a better way to write the story.
Okay. How often does that happen for you? Does that, you say you walk around telling the story, that's sort of like kinesthetic, the movement of a story
sure.
really helps you, and it sounds like talking the story through helped this person learn about the story. What are some other techniques that you've got for that?
Sure, well sometimes I will write the story as I remember it, and then I'll look at it and say, wait a minute, why don't I take a minor character and make them major? And what would be the first thing that they say? And the biggest thing is that I ask people about the story. I recently was at a hotel, and I hate hotel walls, so one of the care attendants, you know, the person checking you in was a 19-year-old. She looked at me and she said, I talked to my orchids, they need the CO2. I thought, wow, this is interesting. And I was doing an environmental retreat. Mm-hmm. And so I began to write a story called Whispering Orchids. And she sent me pictures of the orchids. And so there are many other ways that you can tell that story. She had no idea I was going to take this two sentences and create these talking orchids from it.
What led to her to say to you, that sounds like a non sequitur. I just all of a sudden,
oh, sure.
I talked
it
to
does,
orchids.
It does, doesn't it? Yes.
$20 for the room, I talked to orchids.
Well, she's eccentric in a good way.
Okay.
And I usually open conversations with things that are not about checking in a hotel. I say, well, you know, what's the most interesting story that happened around here? Okay. And she told me about the kittens and the cat that they had to adopt because they couldn't get away, and the haunted room, and then the fact that she doesn't advertise that a certain room had a murder in it. And all this came from asking more than how much is the room charge.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a danger inherent to writers and, in this case, storytellers, because you're going around and you're asking that, but you get trapped. I would worry about
talk
getting,
to me about trapped. What do you mean?
I would wonder, you're saying something like that, what happens when the people begin telling you, I talk to orchids? I'm wondering how much further it goes, and my car responds. You know,
sure,
what happens to the story?
Yeah, well, you take some safe distance, you know, but at the same time, you listen. We don't listen well enough. I mean, you know, we're constantly in a hurry, and we're trying to get from one place to another. I have a philosophy called no time for a hurry. So even if your brain, if you're in a hurry, you have to slow down and think about things. And so, you know, the great things happen in airports or children's conversations or you know, when you're lost. You know, you've got to look at it differently.
I mean, it's like a psychological way to get past a certain kind of guardedness.
Oh, sure.
That you,
sure.
You
we have to
down.
Let go. If you truly want to find, I've met people who come up to me and say, I've been working for this story for 20 years, and it's kind of fixed. And then I work with them, and I say, well, wait a minute, let's play with it a little bit. But they have to be ready. So that's why I say when I work with you in a coaching mode, it has to be a story that you're ready to let go. It's not finished yet, and you're ready to look at it in a different way. And as you know, I've talked to some people in writing programs, and I say, how often do you work with other people in your writing, where you're sharing ideas and exchanging? And I was saddened to hear that not as many. They said, oh, well, it's kind of a vacuous ability. And I've talked to a lot of writers and storytellers, and they grow because they have a place to bounce off of.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were at Ohio State as a storyteller in residence.
Right.
So you've talked to people there and people at other writing institutions. What did you do at Ohio State as the writer and storyteller?
Academic storyteller in residence. Right. I actually worked with Multicultural Center, mm-hmm. and we used stories to address issues of equity and diversity. And I started a project in 1995 called the Story Box Project, where we actually had a physical box of stories that I was supposed to send to Brazil. But by the time it got to Brazil, Argentina wanted it, Boston wanted it, Israel wanted it. And mm-hmm. over the last year, we had 50 story boxes held all over here, including the Center for Teaching and Writing. Mm-hmm. And then we put them together and send them all over the world. And once those boxes arrive, people look at the stories, and then they contribute to the stories, and then they send it off. They don't pay to get it, they pay to pass it forward. And I've been doing that since 1995, and we used that at Ohio State. It was a great project.
When the boxes come back, they eventually come back.
They just came back about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. When you open them, what are you getting out of them?
Well, it's about events. Mm-hmm. It's not about a physical box of stories. It's mm-hmm. about having an event that says this is story space. This is a place where we can open a box. Where I am at Ohio Dominican University, we're celebrating our 100th year, and we are having story boxes, and people are recalling their experiences, both past and present, with the story box. Mm-hmm. And then people open it up and they share. It's a sharing event and exchange.
But it's sharing other people's stories.
Sharing other people's stories, writing stories. Each person who has a box is a story keeper, so they create events to promote story activity.
Okay. What happens during those times if you have an unexpected story? Right, somebody, I assume that they're not chosen in advance or something like this. When they take them out of the box, they read them? Or do you
sure,
set them up?
Sure. I call it global sharing and global publishing, mm-hmm. but nothing is edited or censored. You know, we do ask that if it's non-kid friendly, that you just write that down so that someone's not surprised in that way. Mm-hmm. And this has been going on since 1995. I've talked to, 2 weeks ago, I talked to someone in Texas who started this project. They've started this project all over the world. And so what happens with the unknown story? Well, that's the beauty of the Story Box Project. You lift it and you go, oh my gosh, talking orchids? What is this? You know? Yeah. But then at the same time, you pick this up and someone just wrote a response. A little girl in Switzerland had a small box and said, I don't have a story, but I have the smallest story box, which was a matchbox. And somebody in Israel picked it up and put tiny, tiny stories. When it came back, that knowledge came back to Switzerland. The story keeper, Natalie Gently, created an entire festival called the Smallest Story Box Festival.
Mm, okay. What's the most unusual story that you've gotten out of it, the most memorable one?
Out of the Story Box?
Out of the Story Box Project.
I'm attracted immediately to Zosa's story, who's from Iraq, who was at Dublin High School, and she told a story of her sisters, I believe, about one day these kids were teasing her, and the next day there was a bomb. And those kids were no more, and she was mad because she felt bad because she felt ill toward these people who were teasing her. Mm-hmm. And then I said, why is this important story? Zos is a quiet little girl. And she said, because the people in Iraq, people in America are looking at the headlines for Iraq, and I have a different story to tell. And people in Dublin are listening to my story, and why shouldn't the world?
Mm, that's a good story. Tell me about the Columbus Area Writing Project. You've been involved.
I'm the co-director of the Columbus Area Writing Project with a number of people, David Bloom here at Ohio State University, and we teach teachers about writing, and then we give teachers time to write during the day, and then in the afternoon we talk about how can we get students to teach, mm-hmm. How can we get teachers to teach writing.
So
they come from different abilities, I'm sorry.
Right. Well, how does that work then? You say we're going to teach you how to write, and then how to tell stories.
We have a summer institute, and it's not as connected to storytelling. It's my other part of life of being a writer. And it's what I said, that we don't really have a lot of time to talk together as writers and as teachers. And the philosophy is that if you can teach writing, and if you like to write yourself, then you will have more productive students.
Mm-hmm. And so you're working with the teachers, and then they go out and work with the students?
Sure. For 4 weeks, we do a summer institute, and then it becomes a greater part of the national writing project.
Mm-hmm. Have you gotten back things from the students that have, from the teachers that are in that? Do you get to be involved with them at all?
We've seen them work with digital storytelling. We've seen them do the Columbus-wide Poetry Slam was by Wick McGowan, who last year had like four schools and now had 10 schools, and they did very powerful poetry, and he credits the writing project as a result.
Okay. Tell me about digital storytelling. That's something you can't put probably in the story box.
No, you can.
Oh, you
can just
put a DVD,
can.
And a CD?
Yeah, you can burn a DVD. That's the whole thing. We don't know what narrative is. Narrative can be an art. Someone, an art teacher brought me almost like an accordion art piece that was designed by second graders. We've had digital stories. We've had audio stories. You never know what's in the box. The box, one of the boxes themselves were made out of yarn from Yellow Springs, and they completely knitted a box. Knit Knot, a famous knitting group called the Jaffa Girls. But to answer your question, I trained with the Center for Digital Storytelling at Ohio State, and I used to be like this holistic storyteller. I'll never tell just by myself, once upon a time, you know. Mm-hmm. But then digital gave me a new face and a new interface to use stories, and I started to use it with my students. It's like another project, Ensemble Storytelling, where I actually now fly in and I work with 20 students and we co-construct a story together and we tell together. That's a new way of using story, and so is digital storytelling.
So it's kind of like a choral reading at the end?
Well, do they all participate? Well, I wouldn't say a choral reading because there's a script to that.
Okay.
If I fly in, like I recently flew into New York, I worked with 25 students from varying abilities, some who loved reading and some who didn't, and we co-created one story together. We took all the ideas because I'm basing it upon improvisation, and then I become what I call a story mediator. Mm-hmm. So I help them accentuate their voice. Okay. And then we performed it for 500 parents and adults, and it was amazing.
And they just remembered what their parts were.
Well,
or they
you see, you're
where
back to that writer's memory, and it's got to work from here.
It's one of the canons.
There you go. But story is about images and characteristics. And so if I said, describe for me, a typical day, that's not specific enough. But if I say, tell me about a turtle that talks, go ahead.
I had a turtle that talked. His name was Kevin. And Kevin the turtle would only come out at night.
So describe him.
He was gray, yeah. He was snapping turtle.
So someone else is going to pick this up, and they're going to say this gray turtle named Kevin. And where am I? I'm mediating. I'm saying, okay, so who has the next idea? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the turtle wore thick glasses. He couldn't see. He was a bumbling turtle. He walked around, and he walked into walls, but there was no walls in the marsh pond, so he was okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And he walked around, and his name was Kevin. And we remember stories by images and words. And memory, of course. But we don't want to underplay that sometimes we can create a picture that connects to the next image. Mm-hmm. And writers only work with words, but sometimes they should draw out their story. Because when you draw a picture, you have to draw the most important thing in that picture so it can be remembered to the next one. Well, imagine storytelling with visual pictures.
You know, that makes complete sense to me in working with language arts.
Well, then we're
arts.
Doing all right.
All right. Okay. Working with language arts and things like that. But you, when you're working at Ohio State or when you were there as a storyteller in residence, I imagine there's this push from the other side, right? How do you tell a story, for example, in science, in chemistry?
Sure.
In
well,
biology?
Let me give you an example. A friend of mine's a West Point oceanographer turned researcher turned scientist.
Okay.
And he wrote a book called Marvels of Science. And he tells the story of why Silly Putty was created. Or you can talk about how a river current, the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, did it not?
Wouldn't you like
to know the story?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it caught on fire?
Oil slick, oil spills.
Okay. All right. That's one person. I'm going to ask one more person, why did it catch on fire? And they might say, well, I don't know, match too close to the water, which of course is, you know, just not feasible. But we can start researching the science and say, well, here's what really happened. Mm-hmm. Here's what combination of the pollution created and ignited the fire. How would you like to be taught, for example, the Titanic? You could show the Leonardo DiCaprio film. I walked into a class and I said, I can show this film, and that was the assignment, or I can tell you about my great uncle who died on the Titanic. What would you like to hear? And of course they wanted to hear my great uncle. My grandmother came up to me and said, your uncle died on that great big boat. I think it was famous.
And this is true.
Yeah, it is true. It is true. So I went to my aunt. I said, you know, my Grandma West said that we have a connection to the Titanic. Oh, don't pay her no mind. But my grandmother doesn't lie. Like anybody other's grandmother, you know, they don't lie.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't. And so I went to the other one, and I went to Aunt Ollie, and Aunt Ollie said, well, you go check it out. If you don't believe it, go check it out. And I looked at Walter Lord's book, and it had on the back all the people who survived. And there was the non-survivor of George West, which was my great uncle. But here's the irony, and this is why it's storytelling. When the Titanic came to Columbus the first time, I walked through, and you're given a ticket as though you're on the Titanic. And by the time we got to the end, I saw the survivors, and there was my great aunt that no one had spoken about.
What had they spoken about?
I have no idea. So here's the new chapter to that story. I have to find out. You know, maybe that everybody liked the uncle and not the aunt. I don't know. But isn't that amazing? Now, Kate Winslet has nothing on that.
Well, no, she's a bit younger, though.
Yes,
you know,
she is.
So she has time.
Yeah. But there was no Heart of the Ocean.
Right.
But a lot of people want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so connecting stories to science or math or history. Mildred Taylor at Green High School, she'd come into class and she'd say, William Howard Taft was so fat, took six people to get him out of the bathtub. I was instantly wondering who this Taft person was.
Mm-hmm.
When they came in, they talked about the Smoot Tariff. She would say it with venom. She would say, ah, and I'm like, I'll go take care of him. Where is he? But it was history.
Mm-hmm.
His story, her story, it was revealed. Math is full of story. Science is full of story. History is full of story. And some people came up and said, you know, I'm a teacher. I don't need to tap dance for my students. Well, sometimes you got to wear better shoes because they're competing with a lot of other stories.
All right. Tell me, so you do all this, and you've got these other things called storytelling marathons.
Sure, or you're talking about the National Youth Storytelling Olympics, or?
Well, I was going to do storytelling.
Oh, well, storytelling marathons. Okay, yeah, something that I created.
Something else.
That when people ask
but
about
we could
stories.
Do that.
No, yeah, please.
It's your story.
Storytelling marathon is you give me a genre, and well, I'll just tease you with a little bit of
the
story.
Tease you of 30 to 60 seconds of a story.
Yeah, or somewhere.
So I come up with anything.
Yeah.
I just do, you know.
Just a way to play.
A way to play. Yeah. And so you've got ghost stories, fairy tales, folk tales, true stories, all these things.
You throw something out, and we'll do a marathon.
All right, so let's do a 30-second a ghost story.
If you go down to Clay County, West Virginia, you'll find Coyne's Graveyard. But you gotta go past Coyne's Graveyard, for there'll be a little old man who lives in a cabin and has three friends. They're actually not friends, they're his dogs. But they're not ordinary dogs, they're mangy mutts. And every now and then, they're hungry. They're hungry all more often because they don't take charity. They may be poor. The preacher came in from the Southern Baptist Church, and he had a plate of fried gravy, and he said, I brought this for you. And he said, get out of here! Get on out of here! And he said, dogs, get him! And that preacher left with mashed potatoes and gravy all over his head. But he was quiet. And he didn't say much, and he didn't get any neighbors coming around until the wind arrived. And then it spoke. That's a teaser.
And that's just the teaser.
Just a marathon.
All right. So that's the beginning of it. You
and
just
that
do.
That story is from an Appalachian tale that has been told in books. It's called The Most Peculiar Thing, or Taily Bone, or Taily Poe. And many people tell different versions of it. Mm-hmm. And so it's fun to play with.
And this is something you learned, as you said, as a child. From
growing up, and then I've read many versions. I've listened to other people tell, and then I've kind of made it my own.
Okay. When did you start doing the performance aspect? Is that something you did as a kid? Is that how you picked it up? Is that what was the
important thing? You know, my mother would sit us down with five brothers and sisters on a dilapidated old couch, and she'd say, "You're not getting up until you hear this story." And then she'd turn off the television. She'd go on and on. I'm not the storyteller in my family. I have a master's in storytelling, a PhD in story narrative and story drama, but my mother's the storyteller.
What differentiates her from the way that you tell the story?
Well, we're both dynamic, but she has that resonance. She came from Clay County, West Virginia, and she says, "Listen and you listen." You ever met someone like that? In a good way, but at the same time.
He says, not quite sure, in a good way.
Exactly.
Okay.
But, you know, and I had to work to get that. I fell in love with story, and, at the same time, I wanted to know more about story. I learned storytelling from old tapes after that. I went to a storytelling festival in Kent State, and there were old people there. They were 40. I was 17, 18. You know, they were ancient.
Right.
And I watched 40 or 40. The first person was Bat Burns, and he got up and said, "Today I'm going to tell you a little bit about Ireland, where I'm from," you know. And I was like, "Whoa, goodness gracious." And I was transported for a place where fairies lived. And then Rebecca Hill, an Appalachian clog dancer, came in. I thought that was something out of The Sink, but evidently it's some type of dance.
Right.
Actually, it's a good form of dance. Would take me to the mountains, and I'd say, "Wow, this is an amazing art." And at 17, I couldn't find professional storytelling anywhere. Mm-hmm. It took me a year to find anyone. So I learned off old cassette tapes, and then they wore thin, and I had to look out. And,
you had to find CDs.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, CDs were long in coming at that time.
Then you get those in the story box.
But then I've been to festivals all over the country, 40 states, England. I was in Singapore for 18 days, just working with animators and the Ministry of Defense. Just in story. That's how important narrative is.
Well, people can see that at your website. Some of these stories. It's kevincordy.org.
kevincordy.com.
.com.
And then they can connect to the story box and all the others.
All right. Well, I thank you, Kevin Cordy.
Oh, no. I thank you. And I thank you the stories that you bring here that we wouldn't get to hear.
Well, I hope they're as animated as yours. So, from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing.